For Christians, the advent of the Messiah, of Christ our Savior, was the most blessed, wonderful event to that point in history. But to the enemies of God, to Satan and his minions, the demons and the fallen angels, the advent of Christ was nothing less than an act of war, an invasion by a hostile force onto their territory with the goal of taking their territory and taking everything that they held dear, that they'd won in the spiritual war. And we're going to look at the advent of the Messiah in beginning in this podcast from the unique perspective of the enemies. And we will start doing that on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all is faithbyreason.net. There you will find hundreds of hours of study material, blogs, and podcasts, so please check it out. So we are continuing our study of the Redeemer of mankind. And as I said in the preview there, we are going to be studying it from a unique perspective, from the perspective of Satan and the fallen angels and demons. How did they see the advent of Christ? And they saw it very differently than we did. The birth of Christ, which we see in this idyllic manger scene where you had, you know, Mary and Joseph and the sweet, adorable baby Jesus, and you had the animals smiling and the shepherds and wise men and all that stuff. And that, of course, isn't completely accurate, and we'll talk about that in the next podcast. But that idyllic scene, which we see every Christmas on in our Sunday school books and on lawns and pictures and everything, it's a beautiful scene. That's from our point of view. But from the point of view of the enemy, it was, again, it was a hostile invasion. It was an act of war. It was D-Day from World War II. It was the invasion at Normandy. It was the Gulf of Tonkin. It was, you name it. It, you name any great battle, any great invasion. That's what it was from the point of view of Satan and the fallen angels. It was an act of war. It was the latest act in a long war that actually began in Genesis chapter 3. How do we know that? Well, because that's in Genesis chapter 3, it's where God declared war on Satan. How did that happen? Well, it happened with original sin. We've talked about this before in the Eden series, but in original sin, Satan, the Nahash, the shining one, which was translated serpent, tempted Adam and Eve to eat the forbidden fruit. And when they did, Satan gained what Adam used to have. Adam and Eve were the kings and queens, king and queen of the earth. The earth was theirs. Adam and Eve were given authority over the earth. When they fell, when they chose Satan's temptation over God's will, Satan gained legal proprietorship over the earth. The earth became legally his. And Satan won that first battle. It was the first, last, and only battle he would ever win. Because right after that, God judged Adam and Eve and the serpent, the Nahash. And as part of that judgment, God gave his declaration of war, where he said, and I'm paraphrasing a bit, he said, I will put enmity or an adversarial relationship between you and the woman and between her seed, her descendants, and your seed, your descendants, your people. And you will bruise his heel. You will give the seed of the woman a wound that will, you know, a non-fatal wound, but the seed of the woman will crush your head. That's a mortal wound. Crushing a head is a mortal wound. Obviously, it's going to, basically, God said that the seed of the woman will destroy Satan and all of his plans. And that was God's declaration of war on Satan. And so with that declaration of war, Satan, now he had his marching orders. He knew now that the seed of the woman, and of course the term seed of the woman is an allusion to the virgin birth, because technically the seed, the sperm as it were, comes from a man, not a woman. So this is, again, an allusion to the virgin birth, even in Genesis chapter 3, and we'll talk about that more in the next podcast. But for our purposes, Satan knew that a descendant of Eve, a human being, a genetic human being, would be what God would use to destroy Satan. So Satan knew that in order to win the war, he would have to make sure that this seed of the woman would never come to pass. Well, how do you make sure that a human descendant doesn't come to pass in order to destroy you? Well, you make sure that there are no human beings left. And Satan's first strategy to do that was outlined in Genesis chapter 6. We've studied Genesis chapter 6 before, And if you look at it from the supernatural worldview, and if you don't know what that is, go to the right navigation bar and go to the categories and click on supernatural worldview, and you'll get the lessons and podcasts there. The supernatural worldview is that when Genesis 6 says the sons of God, the B'nai HaElohim, which is a title of angels, and it is angels, they're angelic supernatural beings, not the sons of Seth, not human rulers, not just righteous men or any of that silliness. They were angels. They came into the daughters of men, into women. They came to women and they had intercourse with them. And from this intercourse, they produced babies. They produced children. These children were called the Nephilim. These Nephilim were part angelic, part spiritual, and they were part physical. They were hybrids. They were not pure human beings. And since they were not pure human beings, they did not qualify as a seed of the woman. And this happened around the time of the patriarch named Yared, according to the Book of Enoch. And for about over 1,000 years, these incursions kept happening with angels coming down and having intercourse with women and producing these hybrids. And after 1,000 years of this happening, it got to the point where they proliferated so much and dominated the earth, and they began to kill and physically eat men. We talked about that very clearly in the Bible, as well as the apocryphal Book of Enoch, which I know is not canon. However, it should be taken seriously because it's quoted twice in the Bible by Peter and Jude. So the Book of Enoch should be taken seriously as a historical document. They subjugated man and destroyed man to so much, and they kept reproducing to the point where by the time of the flood, there were almost no human beings left. So it looked like Satan was winning. Satan, after 1,000 years of these incursions happening, there were fewer and fewer human beings left, and it just looked like Satan was right on the cusp of winning. Because, again, if the earth has no more pure humans left, then God's declaration of war will be invalid. The seed of the woman can't crush him if there is no seed of the woman. But God, in dramatic fashion, and we'll find this as a pattern as we go along this narrative, God always pulls victory from the jaws of defeat. Satan looks like he's about to win. This will happen over and over again. You'll see this. It looks like Satan is about to win, and he's just about to get his victory, and then God just dramatically, at the very last moment, pulls the rabbit out of his hat and saves things. And so at the time of the flood, the Bible very strongly implies that there was only one family left. And again, they were possibly several hundred million to 2 billion people are creatures, living creatures on the earth at that time. And out of all of them, there's only one family, 8 people who are purely human. That was Noah, his wife, his 3 sons, and their wives. Those 8 people were the only pure humans left. So God saved them. He just, again, took the last pure humans left and wiped out the rest in the flood. So just when Satan thought he was winning, he was one generation away from achieving his victory, God snatches it away from him and floods the entire earth and kills all the rest. And so then humanity began to reproduce from the descendants of Noah. So Satan had his next strategy. He figured, well, if I can't corrupt all of mankind genetically, maybe I'll corrupt them all spiritually. And that's when we have the Babel incident in the third dispensation, where everyone was of the same language. And they were building a tower to God. And again, it wasn't a tower to reach the heaven because they thought God was in the sky. We talked about this in the Babel narrative. You can go into the third dispensation series and look at that. It was basically going to be a gateway, a stargate, for lack of a better term, because there are certain places on the earth where there is a gateways to the spiritual world, the spiritual dimension. Mount Hermon is one. That's where the angels descended in the time of Yared for Genesis chapter 6. There, Babel was another place where they were building it, this gateway. And then you also have in later in the book of Genesis where Jacob saw this ladder and angels ascending and descending from this portal. They were gateways. So there are places around the earth where angelic beings can come and go. And in the Babel narrative, they were building one of these, and the Bible says they would have been successful. They were just about ready to go. So Satan had corrupted all of mankind under Nimrod, all of mankind, and they were just about to build a gateway into heaven to invade. And God, again, at the last minute, snatches victory from the jaws of defeat. He curses them. He confuses their language, and he scatters them all, and he saves. He makes for his own. He scattered them all. And it all became nations, all the different nations of the earth, except for one, and that one was Abraham. God took Abraham out of the midst of paganism and made him the progenitor of God's own nation. He took an idol worshiping Gentile from Mesopotamia named Abraham, and through him raised up seed that would result in God's own nation. So another thing you'll find as we go along is that as God made his plan more and more clear as to where exactly the Messiah would come from, the genetics that he would go through, Satan will begin to focus on them. So when God made it clear that Abraham and his seed would be the one through whom the Messiah came, well, Satan focused on them. So Abraham, who was, again, about 70, 80 years old when God calls him out of Mesopotamia, and Abraham was, forgive my language, Abraham was a badass. If you read what he did in Genesis, Abraham, again, he was an old guy. He was 70, 80 years old, but he goes into a new land. He's fighting wars. He's like wiping out hostile armies, and he becomes the richest man in the world. I mean, Abraham was a tough guy. I mean, we don't really, if you don't really read things carefully and take them into perspective, you don't realize Abraham was really the world's first superhero, for if you want to look at that genre. He was a bad dude. And he went through his trials and tribulations, but he grew in faith with God, and he had a son named Isaac. Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob's 12 sons became the progenitors of the 12 tribes of Israel. And when you read through the narrative of their journeys in Genesis, you will see that, again, you see the pattern of them almost being wiped out. You have the Sodom and Gomorrah issue. You have Jacob's brother Esau who tried to kill him. And all these, Satan kept coming after them, but God kept saving them. And then finally, Jacob's 12 sons and their families went into Egypt during a famine. And then we have the classic story of Exodus, which we've actually been talking about as part of this dispensational study, the fifth dispensation, the dispensation of the law, where they were doing well, and then Satan raised up a pharaoh who did not know Joseph, who was the son of Jacob, who had a good reputation in Egypt for the good things he did. And the pharaoh at the time of Joseph was on the side of Israel, and he gave the Jewish people, the sons of Jacob, you know, prime land. He was treating them really well. But then God raised up another pharaoh who enslaved them and was, you know, keeping them subjugated. And after 400 years, the Israelites still kept growing. And this pharaoh, the pharaoh of that time, 400 years later, became very, very afraid of the Israelites numerically. He thought that they might, you know, eventually become so big in number, they would rebel and overthrow him. So he decided to do something. He decided to kill all the firstborn males. What would that have done? Well, if you have a generation where there are no male children left, well, you're pretty much done. You're the entire race is going to die out, or those people would die out in one generation. You have no males. You can't have any more children. So, and he did that. He started killing off all the children. So it looked like Satan was about to win again. He was about to wipe out God's nation through whom the Messiah would come in one generation. Except God did his dramatic thing again. God has a flair for the dramatic. He saved one. That one was named Moses. Not only was Moses saved from death, he was saved by the Pharaoh's daughter. The very Pharaoh who ordered all these Israelite baby boys to be killed. Moses was saved by his daughter, and Moses ended up growing up in the household of that same Pharaoh. So again, God's flair for the dramatic and God's sense of irony, that the Pharaoh who was trying to wipe out the Israelites ends up raising their savior, and he grew up in their house. And of course, you know the story of the Exodus and the plagues and Moses leading the people out of Egypt and towards the promised land. And so Satan knew that the Messiah would have to be born in the land of Israel, in the land of Canaan, as they called it, the promised land. And so Satan decided to put down a minefield. He populated the promised land, the land of Canaan, with more Nephilim. There was a second incursion. Now, there are some people who don't believe that there was a second, and by second incursion, I mean more angels came down and had intercourse with women. There are some people who don't believe in a second incursion. They believe, and this is kind of trivial, I'm just bringing it up because I've been seeing it quite a bit lately. There are people who don't believe in a second incursion. They believe that, for whatever, I don't know why they have such a problem with the idea that angels could do again what they did in Genesis 6. But they believe that apparently some of the Nephilim survived the flood, and those are the same, those are the Nephilim who were in the Promised Land. Huge problem with that. Well, two problems with that. Number one, it makes God a failure. And number two, it makes him a liar. It makes him a failure because God said that the flood would wipe out all of the Nephilim. And if Nephilim survived, then God failed. And I don't believe that God's capable of failing. Also makes the God a liar because God said that all flesh on land were wiped out. And if they were not wiped out, then God lied. So there was no, they didn't survive the flood. There was another, there was a second incursion. Anyway, the point is that Satan laid down this minefield in the Promised Land and populated it with Nephilim, these giants. And Nephilim happened to be giants. They were huge in stature. They were extremely formidable, scary creatures. And so when the Israelites had journeyed from Egypt and were overlooking the Promised Land, Moses sent out spies. He sent out 12 spies to spy out the land to see what was going on. And 10 of those 12 spies came back with a report that said, hey, they're Nephilim in this land. These guys are giants. We look like grass. We look like insects in front of them, before them. We can't go there. And they started, and they incited the rest of the Israelites, and they were angry with Moses, and they were saying, hey, we should just go back to Egypt and go back into slavery because it's better to be slaves than to be killed. And so that would have been the end of it because the Messiah had to come from Israel. And the Israelites, all the Israelites wanted to go back, wanted to overthrow Moses and go back to Egypt and serve them again. So it looked like Satan was about to win again because all the Israelites were ready to turn back. All of them except two, Joshua and Caleb. God again snatched victory from the jaws of defeat, and God wiped out the rest of the Israelites over 40 years. They were not allowed to enter the Promised Land until all the people, all the adults who wanted to go back to Egypt died off. And so Joshua and Caleb, the two good spies who said, hey, you know what? God's on our side. Let's go get these Nephilim. If God is for us, he'll take care of it. They lived, and the children of that generation went into the Promised Land. And of course, throughout the book of Joshua, you have all the different battles where, you know, God, and by the way, I talk about this in a supernatural worldview, but I want to bring it up again because it's something that comes up a lot, especially when you have skeptics and people who doubt the Bible or doubt God's goodness. They always bring up the idea, well, you know, if God was so good, why would he tell the Israelites to go into certain villages and certain cities in the Promised Land and wipe out every man, woman, and child? God basically told people to commit genocide. You can understand God saying, you know, we can go out and defeat the soldiers because they were a hostile force. But the women and the children and the animals too, that seemed pretty cruel until you do a little more study and realize that all the people who God told them to wipe out like that were all Nephilim tribes. They were not human beings. God was not committing genocide against innocent human beings. He was telling them to wipe out Nephilim, which were, again, angel-human hybrids. They were not humans, and they also did weird stuff with animals, and they corrupted the animals too. That's what God was doing. That's the reason he brought about the flood, was because Nephilim and human beings cannot coexist. And the Nephilim will eventually wipe out the humans. So the only way for Israel to survive is if there were no more Nephilim in the land. So that's what that's about, in case you didn't you didn't read that or hear that in the Supernatural Worldview series. So the Israelites were in the Promised Land. They're in the land of Israel, and they're doing pretty well for a while. They have their ups and downs, but eventually they get a king, the first good king of Israel, the King David, man after God's own heart. And David does pretty well. He has just his issues here and there, but overall, David was a very good king and a legendary king. And it seemed like things, again, were going well for Israel, except David's kids weren't so great. He has sons called, you know, Absalom and some of the other ones. They did some really horrible things. His royal heir, Solomon, he started out really well. He was known as the wisest man on earth. God gave him great wisdom, and he did well for a while. But then he got corrupted. He got into all these arranged marriages in order to make treaties. He had 700 wives. Again, they weren't, I mean, he wasn't with all these 700 women. I mean, he had to be quite a stud to manage all those women. But they were really marriages in order to unite kingdoms and to enter into peaceful treaties. That's what those were all about. But they began to influence him, and Solomon became corrupted by the paganism. And it was shown through Solomon's sons. Solomon's sons, his descendants, became paganistic, and it got so bad that Israel had a civil war. The 10 tribes in the north of Israel fought against the 2 southern tribes, and they split apart. And this northern tribes got worse and worse until they were finally wiped out by the Assyrians. So Satan was doing well. Now he had the Assyrians take over the northern part of Israel, and then the southern kingdoms, basically the kingdom of Judah. And Benjamin, they were doing okay. They did well. They had some bad kings. They had a couple of good kings who came through for them. However, after a while, they went the same way as the northern kingdom. They went into the paganism, and they started worshiping the false gods, and they got worse and worse until finally there was a king called Jeconiah, who's also called Coniah or Jehoiakim. He has those different names, but he's the same person, and we'll talk about why that's important in a minute. He was so bad. He offended God so greatly that God pronounced a blood curse on him. God pronounced a curse on him that said that no one of his lineage, none of his blood descendants, would ever prosper on the throne of Israel. And I'll put that verse in the show notes. Why is that important? That's important because the Messiah is supposed to be a descendant of David and a royal descendant of David. He's supposed to be the king of Israel. That is one of the titles of the Messiah. The Messiah has to be of the lineage of David. He has to be a blood relative of David and of the house, of the royal house of David. But God just pronounced his blood curse on Jeconiah, saying that no descendant of Jeconiah of the royal line would ever prosper as king of Israel. That seems to be a contradiction that God can get around. How could the Messiah be of the descent, be of the royal line of David and of the lineage of David, and be king of Israel, if the curse he pronounced on Jeconiah comes to pass, where none of his descendants can ever be king? And at this point, you have to think that Satan, they're about to have a party down in Satan's realm, saying, "We finally got him. God's caught in a contradiction. There's no way out of this." Except, again, God's flair for the dramatic. And we have and to understand exactly what happens next, we need to first go back to Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, this was the second law giving, where an incident happens which seems kind of trivial at the time and doesn't make any sense until you get to the New Testament. But basically, the incident was this, and I'm paraphrasing it. There were some women who were due land. They had a land grant. They were supposed to get a certain amount of land in Israel. However, their males, their husbands, had died. And in the ancient Near East, the tradition was that only men could inherit. It could inherit land and title. Well, these women came to Moses and said, "Hey, look, we're due this land grant, this inheritance from our husbands, but our husbands are dead. What do we do?" So God made a provision that allowed women to inherit land and title. And again, first of all, that does two things. One, it shows that despite what certain unbelievers and atheists and secularists say, the Bible is not anti-woman. The Bible does not subjugate women. In fact, the Bible is the only book in the ancient Near East that gave women those kinds of rights. The Bible gave women the right to divorce a man, unheard of in the ancient Near East. It gave women the right to inherit property, again, unheard of. And it gave them the right to inherit title. You would not find that anywhere else in the ancient Near East. Only the Bible gave women those privileges. Okay, great. What does that mean? Why does that? What does that have to do with the Messiah? Well, it kind of gets around that loophole, that contradiction, that alleged contradiction, because you see, when you get to the New Testament, you get the genealogy of Jesus. In the first chapter of Matthew, you have the Jesus's genealogy, and Matthew, being a good Jew, starts his genealogy with King David and goes all the way to Joseph, who was Jesus's legal father. Joseph was not his biological father. Obviously, Jesus was a virgin birth. Joseph had nothing to do with the birth of Jesus, but he adopted Jesus, so he was his legal father. Joseph is of the line of David. He's of the house of David. He's of the royal line. anyone who was Joseph's legal heir, his firstborn, which Jesus was technically was as his first adopted son, he had the right, the royal right. However, Joseph was Joseph was of the royal line. He was of the blood, the genealogy of Jeconiah, who was cursed. So Joseph couldn't inherit royalty because God put that blood curse on him. However, if you go to the book of Luke, Luke was a Gentile. Luke was interested in Jesus' humanity. So Luke's genealogy doesn't just go to David, it goes all the way to Adam. No, it's done in reverse order when you read it. It's actually, Matthew starts with David and goes to Joseph. Luke starts with Mary and her father and goes all the way back to Adam. But while the genealogy in Matthew, Joseph's genealogy goes from David to Solomon, the royal line, the genealogy in Luke does something a little different. Instead of going through David's first son, Solomon, who was the king, it went through David's second son, Nathan, who was not the royal line, because the firstborn would be the next king, which was Solomon. It went through Nathan, his secondborn son, who was obviously of David's genes, and he was of David's lineage, but he was not royal. Mary is not a descendant of Solomon, meaning Mary is not a descendant of Jeconiah, which means that Mary is not subject to the blood curse. So Jesus's physical mother was of the line of David, but not of the house of Jeconiah. So Jesus is not subject to that curse because Mary was not of that that corrupted line. And Joseph was Jesus' legal. So Joseph gets, Jesus can get the, he gets the right to be king from Joseph, but he avoids a blood curse by being from Mary. And because of the incident in Deuteronomy, which I just talked about, Mary, technically, when Jesus was born, he was born fatherless. And so, of course, because Joseph was not his legal father, Jesus was born, Joseph had not married Mary. Joseph was not legally married to the Virgin Mary. Because, again, remember, we talked about this a few podcasts ago, marriage is sex. Sex is a marriage covenant. Joseph did not have sex with Mary until after Jesus was born. And yes, he did have sex with her afterwards. Sorry to burst the Catholic bubble. The Catholic believe that Mary remained a virgin throughout her life, even though the Bible clearly says Mary had sons and daughters. Two of those sons, Jude and James, wrote books in the Bible, but I guess Catholics just ignore that and we'll deal with Catholics later. But Joseph had intercourse with Mary after Jesus was born and became legally married after that. But before, when Jesus was born, Mary was not married to a man, so she fell under that dictate in Deuteronomy that allowed a fatherless women who were unmarried and had children to inherit land and title. So she was able to inherit that title for Jesus, and Joseph, as his legal father, when he adopted him, gave him the right to be of the house of David. So Jesus was of the house and the lineage of David without being subject to that blood curse. So it's a little convoluted, but it's just another way that God shows his flair for the dramatic and just frustrates Satan's plans over and over again. And again, I just mentioned a few of those signposts from Genesis to the birth of Jesus. There are many, many more. You can go to, like, in the book of Esther, where they're about to wipe out the Jews. It's going to be the first Holocaust, and God uses Ruth. I'm sorry, not Book of Ruth. Excuse me. Yeah, the Book of Esther, where God uses Esther and her uncle, Mordecai, to save the Jews from there. They're just throughout the Bible. You keep getting these instances where Satan is about to win. He's about to wipe out the Jews, or in the royal line, and God just snatches victory out of the jaws of defeat every single time. It's almost like if you've seen the old cartoons of Charlie Brown, Peanuts comic from Charles Schulz, where Charlie Brown is always getting fooled by Lucy, who's holding the football for him to kick, and she keeps convincing him, hey, you know what, this time you're going to really kick that football, and he believes her, and he goes to kick the ball, she snatches it away, and he crashes to the ground. It's like that. Every time Satan thinks he's about to kick that football, God snatches it away. It's almost funny, and again, it shows God's sense of humor, his sense of irony, and his flair for the dramatic. And the Bible, the entire Bible, is can be looked at as a narrative of God's dramatic way of just always preserving a remnant. Every time Satan thinks he's going to win, God preserves a remnant to keep his plan going. And He didn't have to be that dramatic, but I believe that God loves stories. He loves drama in a good way. And I believe that's why he created us, because we're all individuals of free will and we all have our own stories. He created billions of people with their own stories because God loves stories and God loves great drama. And God is the instigator of the great drama. And this war, and as I said, the Eden was Satan's first and only win. Ever since then, Satan has just failed over and over and over again, showing that he is a cosmic loser. That is Satan's destiny, to constantly lose. And he lost all the way up to the birth of Jesus, and he will continue losing all the way up until Armageddon and the millennium and his final destination to hell. He will just lose and lose and lose, even if it looks like he's winning. And honestly, if you look at the world today, it looks like Satan's winning, doesn't it? I mean, you look at a country like the United States, which was founded on Christian values. And if you look at the country today, you know, over 200 plus years later, there are very few Christian values left. You can no longer pray in schools. The government's not even allowed to have the Ten Commandments on a court building. They can't have crosses. On the tombs of military people. I mean, everywhere you look, it looks like Satan's winning. They just had this recently here in, not here in New York, I'm not in New York, but here in the United States, in New York, you had some kind of provision passed where you can essentially abort a baby after it's born. Again, seriously? I mean, it's one thing to abort a baby in the womb. That's a whole other thing, which, you know, we can get into that and how that's actually, it is murder, because that baby is alive. It has a heartbeat. It has feelings. But to say that you could take a baby out of the womb and still kill it, and that that's okay, and that there are actually people in Congress who are signing off on that, unbelievable. It just seems to be getting worse and worse. It seems like Satan is going to win, but he won't. At the last minute, God will. And we know this from the book of Revelation and Thessalonians and all the other prophetic books. We know that even though it looks like Satan's going to win, God is going to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. You know, again, read the all the apocalyptic books, read Revelation, and look what happens. And just when, you know, at the Battle of Armageddon, it's not much of a battle, actually. It's just, as they say, it's one of those two-hit battles. You know, God hits Satan, Satan hits the ground. But it looks like Satan has all of mankind marching against Jerusalem, all the armies of the world. It looks like Satan's going to win. And what happens? At the last minute, Jesus comes back on a white horse and wipes them all out. So again, that's his destiny. He is the eternal loser. But just bringing it all back to the advent of the Messiah, the purpose of this podcast was just to show you how God does his warfare. And we'll talk about one more. Okay, I'll give you a brief hint. I know we're up to the half hour point, but and we'll talk about this more in the next podcast when we talk about the Nativity, the birth of Jesus. But remember that Herod ordered that all the kids, when Herod heard that the Messiah was born, he ordered that all boys under the age of 2 be wiped out. He basically was doing what Pharaoh did hundreds of years earlier. And what happened? God got Jesus and took in. Told Joseph to take Jesus to Egypt until that time had passed. So Satan kept trying. He didn't stop when Jesus was born. I mean, there was no time out because he was going against an infant. Satan doesn't really have much of a conscience. So he was still trying to wipe out Jesus in his infancy. And again, he failed. He just kept on failing. And his biggest failure when he thought he had it was when Jesus was on the cross. He thought, hey, I've got him now. I've got him dead to rights. And again, we'll talk about that. I'm getting ahead of myself. But obviously what happens, he thinks Jesus is dead, so that's done, God failed, and then of course there's a resurrection, and Satan loses yet again. All right, let's wrap this podcast up. We're at the bottom of the hour. So thank you for listening, I appreciate it. In the next podcast, we will talk about the birth of Jesus. We'll get into some of the myths around the birth of Jesus, and talk about how some other religious type folks, non-Christian religious folk, tried to appropriate the birth of Jesus and attribute it to other things. It's just based on this this video I was watching of this one guy who tries to make the case, as many non-believers do, that Jesus was just made up, that he is nothing more than the Jewish version of some other ancient stories of the birth of the Son of God, by a virgin and all this stuff, which is utter nonsense. We'll get into that. But we'll go over some of the myths of the birth of Jesus and show and continue to show how the warfare continued in the next podcast. So again, thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Please give me your comments and follow me on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. And please subscribe to Faith by Reason by putting your email into the right navigation bar so you will get podcasts and blogs when they are posted. And I will talk to you again next week.